The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hi. Thanks for coming. It's a very strange thing to write a memoir, particularly when it concerns your son's genitals. I've been on the road for a while, and it's very weird to have people come over to you and they say, look, I really like the book. Can you sign it for me? It's really great. I didn't like the ending, which is weird because it's my life. So I thought I'd read a few sections of the book, some that explain the dilemma, and others that just are toward the end of the book, where we make the decision that the focus groups didn't like that much. By way of explanation, I was raised in a fundamentalist sort of community. It happened to have been Jewish, but it doesn't really matter. They're all the same. Kind of a dysfunctional family and an incredibly psychotic God. And so that led to certain problems in my life that haven't entirely gone away. As a kid, actually, my rabbis told me that my whole job in life was to get to know God. And then they spent 20 years telling me what a prick he was. So this is kind of the book I wrote about him. The epigraph reads, "And the Lord said unto Moses, this is the land I promised you, but you shall not enter. Psych." Verse 5, "And Moses died." When I was a child, my parents and teachers told me about a man who was very strong. They told me he could destroy the whole world. They told me he could lift mountains. They told me he could part the sea. It was important to keep the man happy. When we obeyed what the man had commanded, the man liked us. He liked us so much that he killed anyone who didn't like us. But when we didn't obey what he had commanded, he didn't like us. He hated us. Some days he hated us so much he killed us. Other days he let other people kill us. We call these days holidays. On Purim, we remembered how the Persians tried to kill us. On Passover, we remembered how the Egyptians tried to kill us. On Hanukkah, we remembered how the Greeks tried to kill us. Blessed is he, we prayed. As bad as these punishments could be, they were nothing compared to the punishments meted out to us by the man himself. Then there would be famines. Then there would be floods. Then there would be furious vengeance. Hitler might have killed the Jews, but this man drowned the world. This was the song we sang about him in kindergarten. God is here, God is there, God is truly everywhere. Then snacks and a fitful nap. I was raised like a veal in the Orthodox Jewish town of Muncie, New York, where it was forbidden to eat veal together with dairy. Having eaten veal, one was forbidden to eat dairy for 6 hours. Having eaten dairy, one was forbidden to eat veal for 3 hours. One was forbidden to eat pig forever, or at least until the Messiah arrived. It was then, Rabbi Napier had taught us in the fourth grade, that the wicked would be punished, the dead would be resurrected, and pigs would become kosher. Yay, I said, high-fiving my best friend, Dove. You should be so excited, said Rabbi Napier, peering with disgust over the top of his thick, horn-rimmed glasses, on the day of God's judgment. The people of Muncie were terrified of God, and they taught me to be terrified of him, too. They taught me about a woman named Sarah, who would giggle, so he made her barren. About a man named Job, who was sad and asked why. So God came down to the earth, grabbed Job by the collar, and howled, "Who the fuck do you think you are?" About a man named Moses, who escaped from Egypt, and who roamed through the desert for 40 years in search of a promised land, and whom God killed just before he reached it, face plant on the 1-yard line, because Moses had sinned once 40 years earlier. His crime? hitting a rock. That's what they tell me. And so, in early autumn, when the leaves choked, turned colors, and fell to their deaths, the people of Muncie gathered together in synagogues across the town and wondered, aloud and in unison, how God was going to kill them. Who will live and who will die, they prayed. Who at his predestined time and who before his time. Who by water and who by fire. Who by sword, who by beast. Who by famine, who by thirst. Who by storm, who by plague. Who by strangulation and who by stoning. Then lunch and a fitful nap. It is Monday morning, 6 weeks after my wife and I learned that she is pregnant with our first child, and I am stopped at a traffic light. The kid doesn't have a chance. It's a trick. I know this God. I know how he works. The baby will be miscarried, or die during childbirth, or my wife will die during childbirth, or they'll both die during childbirth, or neither of them will die, and I'll think I'm in the clear. And then, on the drive home from the hospital, we'll collide head-on with a drunk driver, and they'll both die later. My wife and child, in the emergency room, just down the hall from the room where only minutes ago we stood so happy and alive and full of promise. That would be so God. The teachers from my youth are gone, the parents old and mostly estranged. The man they told me about, though, he's still around. I can't shake him. I read Spinoza, I read Nietzsche, I read National Lampoon. Nothing helps. I live with him every day, and behold, he is still angry, still vengeful, still, eternally, pissed off. Man plans, my parents said, and God laughs. When you least expect it, my teachers warned, expect it. And I do. All day long, a never-ending horror film festival plays in my mind, my own private grand guignol. There isn't an hour of the day that goes by without some gruesome, horrific imaginings of death, anguish, and torment. Walking down the street, shopping for groceries, filling the truck with gas. Friends die, beloveds are murdered, pets are run over by delivery trucks and killed. Up ahead, past the intersection where the road bends sharply to the right, cars slow, brake lights flashing as they disappear around the bend. An accident, I imagine, and I imagine driving by. Shithead, I will criticize the driver. Ought to know better than to speed around here. When I recognize the car, it is a black Nissan. That looks like Orly's. And then I see my wife behind the wheel, crushed, bloody, head back, tongue out. She's dead. I can bring myself to tears this way. If I'm in a particularly self-loathing mood, I may, like a Reuters photographer, place a child's toy in her blood-soaked lap, or a colorfully gift-wrapped box on the dash above the very spot where her head had bashed it in. Exterior, daytime, later. I am sitting on the guardrail, inconsolable. You're still young, says a police officer. Whole life ahead of you. She was pregnant, I whisper. Close up on the face of the hardened police officer. He has seen it all. But this, a tear rolls down his face. Finn. Our unborn baby is the newest star of my horror shows. Just 6 weeks now since conception, and already it's been deformed, deranged, diseased, miscarried, misdiagnosed, mistaken for a tumor and irradiated, sat on, bumped into, impaled during some ill-advised late-term sex, and overcooked when Orly fell asleep in a steaming bath. Are you sure about this? I had asked her as she sank with a sigh into the tub. Seems a little hot. When I was young, they told me that when I died and went to heaven, the angels would take me into a vast museum full of paintings I had never before seen, paintings that would have been created by all the artistic sperms I had wasted in my life. Then the angels would take me into a huge library full of books I had never read, books that would have been written by all the prolific sperms I had wasted in my life. Then the angels would take me to a huge house of worship, filled with hundreds of thousands of Jews, praying and studying, Jews that would have been born if I hadn't killed them, wasted them, mopped them up with a dirty sock during the hideous failure of my despicable life. There are roughly 50 million sperms in every ejaculate. That's about 9 Holocausts in every wank. I was just hitting puberty when they told me this, or puberty was just hitting me, and I was committing genocide 3 or 4 times a day. They told me that when I died and went to heaven, I would be boiled alive in giant vats filled with all the semen I had wasted during my life. They told me that when I died and went to heaven, all the souls of every sperm I wasted during my life would chase me for eternity through the firmament. You don't have to be ordained to play this game. All you need is terror, bloodlust, and a sense of gruesome, violent irony. Here's mine. I worry that God puts all the healthy, perfect, talented sperm in the early ejaculates of a man's life. The man's someday reward for the control he's had over his revolting animus. And that, as the years pass and he ejaculates again and again, sperm quality plummets. By the time he is me, all that's left are the rejects. The cross-eyed, the buck-toothed, the overbitten, the underbitten, the flippered of foot, the webbed of finger, the idiots, the lazy, the criminals, the morons, the yutzes, the putzes, the schmucks. That would be so God. So, a few months later, my wife and I discovered that what we're having is a boy, which created some problems. So I'm going to read a bit from that moment. As the obstetrician's nurse pulled on her exam gloves and rubbed conductive gel on Orly's belly, Orly smiled and reached for my hand. I smiled, gave her hand a squeeze, and thought about the first time God tried to kill Moses. "This is going to be a little cold," said the nurse. Moses and his wife Zipporah were out for a stroll with their son Gershom when a giant serpent swallowed Moses, head first, right down to his waist. "Is that the baby?" Orly asked, her voice almost a whisper, her eyes fixed on the sonogram monitor. "Sure is," said the nurse. The serpent quickly released Moses, only to swallow him again, this time feet first. As he had done so earlier, the serpent stopped at Moses' waist. "Do you want to know?" asked the nurse with a grin. Orly looked at me and shrugged. I shrugged back. "Okay," she said. It didn't take long for Zipporah to understand that Moses was being attacked because they hadn't circumcised their son. She immediately picked up a flint, chopped off her son's foreskin, and the serpent released her husband. "It's a boy," said the nurse. Orly smiled at me. "A what?" I said. "A boy," said the nurse. "Are you sure?" I asked, leaning over Orly to squint at the monitor. "Oh, I'm sure." "It looks like a girl," I said. "You're leaning on my stomach," Orly said to me. "Been doing this for 10 years, said the nurse. "It's a boy." "Where?" I asked. "I don't see anything." "You're leaning on my stomach," Orly said. "Sorry." The nurse pointed to a blurry white smudge on the screen. "Boy," she said with authority. "I can have the doctor come in if you want a second opinion." "That's okay," said Orly. The nurse pushed the monitor to the side and stood. "Hoping for a girl, were you?" she asked, handing Orly some wipes to clean the gel off her belly. "Boys are easier." "Maybe," I said, "but you don't have to cut anything off girls." I'd been dreading this. If I didn't know for certain that God was a prick who spends his time figuring out hilarious ways to screw me, I might have even prayed for a girl. But I knew if I did, he definitely would have given me a boy. I could have tried the reverse psychology thing, pray for a boy to get a girl, but I was pretty sure he'd see it coming. Then he'd give me 2 boys. Twins, just to screw me. And everyone would say, "Oh, what a blessing," and I'm sure that they would be. But I alone would know the truth, their X's and Y's, blessing or not, arranged in malevolence. And then I'd get all pissed off and decide not to circumcise either of them, just to spite the son of a bitch. But he'd hear my thoughts and know my plans, and he'd make them conjoined twins. Connected, ha-ha, by their foreskins. What, he'd totally do that. So I'd have no choice but to cut them. And hidden within that punishment, of course, one of those cautionary subtexts he loves so much. Honor my covenant with Abraham, or surely thy children shall piss all over each other all the days of their lives. Or, if thou shalt not bind them unto me, I shall bind them unto each other. A situation that, now that I think of it, would be perfect. Not the pissing on each other, but their being connected by their foreskins, because then I'd have no choice but to circumcise them. Hell, they'd probably do it right there in the hospital, and then at least I wouldn't have to make the decision myself. The nurse gathered up her papers and headed for the door. If it helps, she said. They don't feel nothing at that age. Thanks, I said. It doesn't. I know, she said. My family and I are like oil and water. If oil made water depressed and angry and want to kill itself. So Orly and I decided to hire a doula to help us with the birth. Her name was Mary, and she came over a few afternoons later to get acquainted. We don't speak to our families, I said. That's sad, said Mary. Not as sad as when we do, I said. Mary advised us on doctors and midwives and supplementation, on amniotomy and its relation to umbilical cord prolapse, on the overuse of epidurals and the underuse of perineal massage to avoid unnecessary episiotomies, on the disadvantages of lithotomy and the advantages of prenatal yoga. She advised us to use comfrey for hemorrhoids, to eat organic vegetables over non-organic, to use raspberry tea over black tea, to take generic prenatal vitamins over the more expensive brand-name prenatal vitamins, and recommended the nearby birth center in Rhinebeck over the local hospital in Kingston. Where do you stand on circumcision? I asked. Mary stepped backwards and held up her hands. That's really your decision, she said. When Mary had gone, Orly and I went for a hike. We moved to our house in the woods of Ulster County nearly 10 years ago. The property backs up on nearly 1,000 acres of protected watershed forest, and there's rarely a day that we miss our hikes along the steep, abandoned logging trails and rock-strewn, dried-up creeks that begin just outside our front door. We talk about our work, our hopes, our fears. We resolve arguments. We apologize if we've been wrong. The trees must be sick of us. Here he goes again with the mother talk, says the maple. I remember, says the surly oak, when they used to get stoned and fuck out here. But what about the Holocaust? I asked Orly that afternoon. Orly sighed. What about the Holocaust? As we walked along an old trail that wound its way up the mountain, I told her the story I'd heard so many times growing up, the story of the old Jewish lady in the concentration camp who circumcised an infant just before its death at the hands of the Nazis. One black evening, the SS had announced that the following morning they were going to kill all the infants in the camp. The old woman began weeping and crying, and she threw herself at the feet of the passing Nazi soldier, begging him for the knife he carried in his belt. The Nazi smiled, thinking that the old Jew wanted to kill herself, and handed her the knife. The old woman fell to her knees and opened the bundle of rags she had been carrying. Inside lay an infant boy, and before the Nazi could stop her, she bent over the baby and circumcised him. You have given us a child, she cried aloud to God, and we return to you, a Jew. It was autumn, and hunting season was a few weeks away. In the distance, someone fired a rifle, and the sound ricocheted off the hills and through the valleys. And then what happened? Asked Orly. I don't know. He killed him, I guess. We walked along a little farther. Sunlight poured through the tall, dark pines. Another gunshot. Deer looked for their passports. Bears begged to hide in their neighbor's attic. I don't know what to do, I said. On the one hand, it's insane. It's mutilation. On the other hand, maybe he should have a connection to his past. On the other hand, I worry God will kill him if we don't do it. On the other hand, I feel guilty not circumcising him when so many Jews in history died for the chance to. I'm like fucking Vishnu here with all these hands. Didn't they kill babies every day? Asked Orly. What? It was the Holocaust, she said. They killed babies every day. It wasn't like, okay, today we're killing babies. Another gunshot, closer this time. I suppose that they did kill babies every day, but explained that perhaps that wasn't the point. The point was how important this tradition had been to the Jewish people. Then again, isn't tradition just another word for that particularly religious, self-righteous, non-thinking inertia that propels so many to extremes they might not ever have engaged in had they stopped to actually consider, to weigh, to examine? It was treacherous enough, I complained, trying to determine my own beliefs, but here I was being asked to determine someone else's, a someone else that hadn't even developed genitals yet, let alone a philosophy of religion. I mean, what if... How did she know how to do a circumcision? Orly asked. Who? The old lady. I don't know. It can't be that difficult. It can't be that difficult? Orly's lineage is a physically appealing but discursively frustrating combination of Middle Eastern and Russian. Relentless interrogation is in her blood. I'm sorry, she continued, but I'm having a hard time believing this Nazi just handed his knife to a Jewish prisoner. A knife is a weapon. And how did she... I mean, you don't just lop it off. It was the Holocaust, hon. She kicked a stone down the trail. I know it was the Holocaust. I just don't see how rounding people up in concentration camps suddenly makes them all moils. That's all. Locking me up in Auschwitz isn't going to make me a fucking surgeon. It was a tense time. We were conflicted about the foreskin, nervous about the baby, and terrified that the introduction of the baby would somehow reintroduce with him the families from which we had worked so long to distance ourselves. The sun began to set, and I called for the dogs, worried that someone was out there getting an early jump on hunting season. Harley and Duke are Rhodesian Ridgebacks, and without their orange safety vests, they look a lot like deer. If I could get one of those vests to protect us from God, I wouldn't even be thinking of circumcising our son. I'm sorry, said Orly. We held hands and headed back down the mountain. It's okay, I said. Story just sounds like bullshit, that's all, she said. I didn't solicit foreskin opinions, but they were offered. It didn't take much. Do you know the sex of the baby? It's a boy. And they're off. Our friend from the posh neighborhood of Brooklyn Heights was in favor of circumcision, for, you know, aesthetically, while my attorney, who is gay, recommended that if we had even the slightest suspicion that our son was homosexual, we should just leave the damn thing on. They're very prized in my community, he said. At least someone was thinking of the boy. I found myself a week later back in Craig's office, sitting across the way from Patricia, a formerly Orthodox, currently Buddhist, macrobiotic, pro-Palestinian animal rights activist art director. I can't believe you're even considering it, she said. Why don't you just cut off his finger, slice off his nose, stab him, knife him, for God, that's what you're talking about, isn't it? I was beginning to feel a bit like a foreskin myself. Why don't you just punch him in the face, she suggested as she gathered her papers in an angry pile and started to leave. Wait 8 days, invite the family over, put out some wine and kugel, and just punch him in the fucking face. A lot like a foreskin. Cut off from my past, uncertain of my future, bloodied, beaten, tossed away. I wondered if there was a place where the foreskins could go, a place they could live together, peacefully, loved, wanted, a nation of the foreskins, by the foreskins, for the foreskins. Patricia slammed the door behind her as she left. Craig sat down in the chair across from me. Listen, he said. He took a deep breath and told me that as far as he was concerned, growing up was difficult enough, and that the only reason he had circumcised his own sons was so that they wouldn't wonder why someday they were different from their dad. And that, he said, seemed like a pretty important reason. I nodded. I liked the whole selflessness angle, but I sighed and shook my head. The fact was, I said to Craig, if I really wanted to ease my son's insecurities by making his penis look like mine, I wasn't going to have to just circumcise him. I was going to have to shave his balls and give him a Prince Albert. Craig looked at me for a moment before checking his watch. I've got a 10 o'clock, he said. So I can read a little bit about the actual, you know, moment of decision, or we could just take questions. I'll keep reading. Okay. Welcome to virtual Jerusalem. What is the Western Wall? The Western Wall, or Kotel, is the only surviving remnant of the temple that stood in Jerusalem. The temple served as the closest connecting spot between the Jewish people and God. During the exile that followed the destruction of the temple, prayer remained as the only means available to maintain a divine connection. Modern technology allows virtual Jerusalem to facilitate the process. Whatever your message, we will place your prayer among the countless others, a testament to the connection between God, Israel, and the Jewish people that refuses to be extinguished. Your prayers will be collected every week and taken down to the wall by virtualjerusalem.com staffers. To send a note to the Western Wall, please log in, fill in the form below, and send your name, your email, your prayer. Limit 200 characters. 6 weeks before our scheduled due date, we still hadn't come to a decision about whether to circumcise our son. We hadn't been discussing it much. Ixnay on the Orskin Fay. But I had gone online and quietly continued my research. I discovered that during the ceremony, an empty chair, reserved for the angel Elijah, is placed near the child, for it is said that so important to God is the ancient ritual that when a man circumcises his son, God calls upon the angels and proudly says, "Come and see what my sons are doing in the world." And Elijah descends to the earth to witness the moment on God's behalf. Zohar 1:93. I discovered that even Fraser Crane circumcised his son. Season 8, episode 167. And he was married to a non-Jew. And I discovered the Smart Clamp, a clear, plastic, at-home circumcision device that looks like a corkscrew designed by Philip Stark. It avoids, according to its website, the problems often associated with circumcision, such as, quote, infection of the circumcised wound, post-operative bleeding, cutting the glands of the penis, part amputation of the penis, and risk of removal of too much or not enough of the foreskin. Come and see what your sons are doing in the world. We went for a hike. Do you want to do this? I asked Orly. I don't know. Do you? I don't know. So the chair is for Elijah? She asked. Apparently. I didn't know that. Me neither, I said. God can't watch it for himself. I don't think that's the point, I said. Yeah, but I thought he could see everything. He can, I said. So what's Elijah for? Nothing. Pictures. Cake. How the fuck should I know? He brings back a nice piece of cake. Is that also in the Zohar? That God loves cake? Yes, it is. Twinkies. Is that why he made them non-kosher? Probably, I said. He's very selfish. Do you want to do this? I don't know, I said. You? I don't know. I also discovered virtualjerusalem.com, where I composed a virtual prayer note for someone to cram into a non-virtual wall to a virtual God who might kill my non-virtual son because I'd eaten bacon with virtually every egg since I was 19, or because I drove on Sabbath, or because I wrote things about God that he didn't approve of. It was worth a shot. Dear God, please don't kill my son during birth. Also, don't kill my wife during birth. And don't kill him after birth. And please make him healthy. And don't fuck around and make him sick just to scare me. I know you're probably pissed at me, but I'm pissed at you too. So let's just keep this between us. Thanks. Shalom. That was 262 characters, not including spaces. I dropped the bit about God fucking around to try and scare me, and that got me down to 212. I missed the part about letting God know I was wise to his little scare tactics. But at last, this version was down to 184 characters without spaces, 225 with. Was the 200-character limit including spaces? It didn't say, and I didn't want to risk it. That was just the kind of fast one God would pull. My son would die, and I would kill myself, and I'd go to heaven and say, "What the fuck?" And he'd be like, "Email? I didn't get any email. Must have been over the character limit." And all the asshole angels would laugh. Dear God, please don't kill my son during birth, and don't kill my wife during birth. I know you're probably pissed at me, but I'm pissed at you too, so let's just keep this between us. Thanks. It lost a lot of the original, but I was down to 196 characters, including spaces. At the last minute, I chickened out and took out the whole pissed section. Dear God, please don't kill my son or my wife. Thanks. Dread is the soul of brevity. There was a problem. Shoulder, said the midwife, shaking her head. Stuck. Here we go, I thought. Here we fucking go. His head was out, along with his right arm, reaching overhead, dipping his hand into the waters of the world, testing it before diving in. Feels cold, Dad. It gets colder, kid. Orly and I had spent the last 9 Tuesday nights in birth classes. The first 3 weeks we learned about every possible complication during labor and how each one could kill our baby. The second 3 weeks we were spent learning about every possible medical treatment of the complications discussed during the first 3 weeks. And during the final 3 weeks we learned about how every one of the possible medical treatments mentioned in the middle 3 weeks could kill our baby. Then they gave us a photo album and a diaper. I held Orly's hand. Our son's face was blue, getting bluer. What do you see, she managed between breaths. Nothing, I said. Moses, I thought. The tease, the peak, a glimpse. This is how this joke of his works. A blue head, a blue-black arm, Moses' pre-mortem peak of the promised land. He's got Orly's lips. An oldie but a goodie, O Lord. He's so blue. An oldie but a goodie. Orly asks, what's going on? I didn't know. I didn't know how much time we had to get him out. I didn't know, he's blue, what the nurses were shouting to one another. I didn't know what the red light meant, the one, he's so blue, that had just lit up on the wall beside her bed. I didn't know what the steel table was for, the one that they had just rolled in, the one with the clear plastic box on top. Do something. And the gray tubes and the yellow cords tied around and clamped together, as if the whole thing had just been pulled out of the back of some storage closet most nurses had never even seen, because the level of badness of a situation rarely do something reached the level where you might need a machine such as this, whatever this machine was. And I didn't know why, for God's sake, do something. A nurse was climbing onto the delivery bed, and I didn't know why she was pressing on Orly's pelvis with her knee. And then Orly was moaning, and the midwife was shaking her head, and the nurse was shaking her head, and she put her second knee on Orly's pelvis. And I didn't know what she was doing, but Jesus Christ, she was all out of fucking knees. If knees are some kind of answer, we're going to need more knees, because mine are shaking too hard to be of any use. Got him, called the midwife. Got him, got him, got him. Keep pressing, got him, got him. I wiped the sweat from Orly's brow, and I laughed, and I closed my eyes and rested my head against hers. And I thought about that expression, the one about God giving unto whoever a son, and about how little it felt like that, how much it felt like as if we'd stolen a son from him, ripped it from his hands. That was what that laugh was about, the same laugh I had when I walked out of Macy's with a bag full of stolen clothes, how at best he dangled it over our heads for a while and made us jump for it like a child for candy as he laughed at our ache and struggle. But give? I didn't feel as if he'd given us anything. It felt as if he'd lost his grip, like he'd given up, like he'd let the babies have their baby. He's not breathing, said the midwife. I'm sorry, I said to God. I'm sorry, holy fucking shit, I'm fucking sorry. Which isn't why we circumcised him. Or maybe it was. I don't know. It happens, said the midwife later. His airways had been blocked. She had suctioned his nose and then his mouth, ventilated him, and he soon began breathing on his own. The following day, the doctor came in, and after some routine checks on our baby, he asked if we intended to circumcise him. We guessed, we said. Thanks for nothing, Google. For every medical reason not to circumcise, there seemed to be a reason to circumcise. For every psychological reason to circumcise, there seemed to be a psychological reason not to. We had the doctor do it. At least there was no God involved. Follow me, said the doctor. And Abraham arose, and he went forth. According to many, this was Abraham's defining moment, the moment he looked around, saw what the world around him had become, and behold, he did leave, saying, fuck this. For this he is considered by the followers of the world's major religions to be their father, followers who laud his courage and strength of spirit in one breath, and threaten in the next any of their flock who might be foolish enough to consider going forth themselves. As I pushed my son's bassinet down the hall, I wondered if this leaving, this searching for something new, this disillusionment with the choices available, is, for some of us, the essential fucked-up condition of our lives. I wondered if we are all foreskins now, and if Abraham were alive today, in Muncie, or Mecca, or Vatican City, I wondered if he wouldn't arise in the morning, pack up his camel, and say, fuck this, all over again. It's okay, said the doctor as he rolled our son into the exam room. I did all my own sons. Oh, we do all our own taxes, I said. You're very funny, laughed the doctor. I pictured the doctor tied to a stake. I pictured pulling up the skin on top of his shiny bald head and snipping it off. I pictured rolling his skin all the way down his body as he screamed and screamed and begged for mercy. And, once it lay there piled up at his bloody feet, I made kiddush on a goblet of wine and had a piece of cake. Yep, very, very funny, he said. I pressed my hands to my ears and turned around. My son screamed. I closed my eyes. Synagogues burned. Torahs were torn to shreds. Gods were banished. The moment my son became a Jew was the moment I felt, more than I had ever before in my life, that I was not. And that's when the meconium really hit the fan. According to someone, the circumcision needs to happen on the eighth day, and it needs to be performed by a God-fearing, Torah-observant Jew. And the God-fearing, Torah-observant Jew needs to place his lips upon the wound and suck blood from it. And I need to say, blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us to enter into the covenant of Abraham our father. I felt as if I'd gotten the right answer on the final round of Jeopardy, but forgotten to phrase the answer as a question. It was the foreskin that broke the camel's back. That's it.
And now we'll have some questions. Folks, we'll have people in the aisles. Raise your hand. We'll get a mic to you. Please wait for the mic. Anybody want to start us off? Right here, fourth aisle.
How old were you when you stopped believing in God?
I haven't yet. I'm old enough and I've read enough to know that it probably doesn't make intellectual sense. But when this is over, I'll call home and make sure my kid's not dead.
Follow-up question?
I mean, just to expand on that a little bit, I kind of started this book with that in mind. That was the thought. It was soon after we had found out we were having a boy, and I was working on some other stuff, but I was furious. I was just furious. Nothing made sense. I was like, I'm here, and I'm 34. It's 2004, and we've got the internet and brain scans and space exploration, and I'm sitting here worrying that if I don't mutilate my son the right way, God's going to kill him. And so I thought that might be worth something writing a book about. Just to put it down, I don't have any answers. I have no idea, and I'm still tortured by it. But the amazing thing of putting the book out and going on tour is seeing how many, honestly, hundreds of people who've come over, emailed, written, secular people, artists, writers, you'd never believe it, who have the same fear. And I'd say half of them are Catholic. It's not a Jewish problem. Muslims, Mormons, Calvinists, we all have the same God. It isn't really a book about Judaism. It's about being taught about that son of a bitch being up there when you're very young and being taught that for a very long time and not being able to get away from it, regardless of what Richard Dawkins says, regardless of how much sense they all make, it doesn't really help. At a core level, I read it. I think it's brilliant. I love him for doing it. And then I put the book down, close off the bedside light, and lie there and listen very closely to the monitor to see if my son's still breathing. Just because I read the book, so it's like it's crazy, but that's me, and it's not uncommon. So I guess I feel a little less crazy having put the book out.
Another question right here in front.
I spent some time as a non-Jew teaching in an Orthodox school, and just became very enchanted with the whole community and interested. And I wonder, how does the Orthodox community react to this book? My guess is they're reading it secretly, but I wanted to know what you would say.
I've said from the very beginning when their newspapers wanted to interview me, I said, listen, just flat out, here's the deal. This is not between me and a Jewish community. This is between me and God, so stay the fuck out of it. But, you know, I was in, I don't know where I was yesterday, but some city that wasn't this city, and after doing a reading, a very earnest young woman came over to me afterward and said, "I think it's awful what you're saying about Judaism." And I said, "Did you read the book?" And she fluttered her eyes self-righteously and said, "I don't want to read the book." And I said, "So you didn't read the book?" And she said, "I don't want to read the book." And all I could think was, if I wrote everything I wrote about the Old Testament and she found out I hadn't even read the goddamn thing, how much more irate would she be? So the truth is, I don't actually care. I don't actually care. For the most part, if there's a problem with it, if they have a problem with what I was taught, they ought to go take their anger out on the people who taught me it. All I did was get straight A's. That's my sin. That's where I fucked up. I listened. If they got a problem with that, that's not my issue.
Next question. About eight rows back, gentleman with his hand up.
You obviously come from an Orthodox background. I have a similar background to what I understood you have.
Sorry to hear that.
Now, when did you have your epiphany? When did you begin to change your attitude, your beliefs? Orthodox Judaism does not teach what you are now talking. So obviously a change has come about. What has caused that change? And that would be very interesting.
Yeah, there wasn't a moment of epiphany. Interestingly, with everybody I've spoken to who also don't look Catholic today or don't look Muslim today, there was no moment. It was, for me, and I talk about this in the book, there wasn't this sort of this famous cycle of faith and doubt. It was appeasement and rebellion. It was mostly stages of being terrified and trying to follow all the rules and moments where I just got angry enough at this character to say, piss off. So, and ultimately that phase just remained longer than the other one did. There was a lot more appeasement in my teenage years. I vacillated quite a bit. And even today, you know, if I do finish this off and start walking a little bit more quickly than I'd like back to the green room to get my phone to call, knowing that's the wrong thing to do, what stops me is not chapter 4 in God Is Not Great. What stops me is thinking, well, screw you. If this is the way you're going to play, kill them all. I'm dead. Everyone's dead. I can't, you know, I don't negotiate with terrorists. So that's my theology.
Another question right in front here.
Hello. I hope my question doesn't seem like too petty or difficult. But it's just something I've been preying on my mind. I heard you on NPR a couple weeks ago, and at the moment you said this, my attention was distracted, and I just wonder if you could happen to remember in what context you said this. You said something, I believe, about if somebody was angry at you 20 years ago, they'll still be angry at you today. Possibly remember what you were referring to when you said that on NPR?
No, but it sounds like me.
All right. Okay.
I don't remember.
Good
They're
enough.
Available for download.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.
Over here to my left, about six rows back.
I'm just wondering. Congratulations, by the way. Scabrous read. So I'm wondering what might be the role of your father in the creation of this, like, sort of violent metaphysical universe that you live in. The portrait of him was extraordinary, by the way, and very visceral.
I would say elemental. I mean, I think obviously there's crossover. I think it would have been nice if one of the people that they had taught me about with the name Father wasn't a douchebag, but both of them happened to be. So they just sort of, it just aggravated. They both aggravated each other. I don't have a problem, incidentally, with it being completely an emotional reaction to a bad father. I'm totally okay with all of belief being emotional reactions. When I'm asked that by the devout, and I say, well, sure, but maybe your love of God is just because Daddy was nice to you, they tend to react poorly. But I'm okay with it if that's the case. But certainly it would have been better if I'd been taught that there was a senior father, you know, CEO type, who was really great and might punish my father. It was more like, even if I got through this guy, even if I got through King Kong, Godzilla was waiting behind him. So it was kind of a hopeless situation. But I'm sure it was all connected.
Right here, third row.
I don't want to give you the bad news, but the dilemma isn't over. How are you going to raise this boy?
Well, right now I'm raising him on Spider-Man and Berenstain Bears. And he really seems to believe in Spider-Man. And there are a lot of good lessons there. I have no idea. I didn't know I was going to have him. I didn't know I was going to go through this. And I don't know what I'm going to tell him. I know that there are five books of Moses worth of things I'm not going to tell him. And that's a pretty good start. He's three, and he's never heard that if he touches his willy, the world's going to flood. So, I win. I'm sure it'll be difficult. I don't know. I'm certainly not going to make it. If I throw him out of the house for saying the G word, he's going to become a rabbi. So I know I'm not going to do that. It isn't going to be evil, and it isn't going to be absolute. It's just going to be, this is what some people think. If he's 18 years old and something bad happens to him, and he has a belief in God, and that comforts him, great. To a certain extent, I'm angry not just at what I was taught, but that for a lot of people, this thing is comforting. When people grow old and die, or people they love get sick, they get to go to a little chapel somewhere and find comfort. I don't get that. I get to sit in the room and wonder why, what I did to cause that cancer, to cause that aneurysm. So I don't have any problem with him finding comfort in it. It beats heroin. Until too many people do it together, and then heroin beats religion.
Another question. Gentleman, the diamond sweater right there.
If you're so annoyed about circumcision, how come 5,500 years later, there's still a lot of Jewish males roaming the world?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
That we survived.
Mm-hmm.
That we're here.
Yeah.
That we made it.
Well, I guess I'd need to see the movie where we don't circumcise and do die to be sure that they connect to one another.
Let me tell you, I've done many circumcisions in my life, and I'm not a moil.
So it's an unbiased question, then.
As a physician, there was a good reason to circumcise males.
Mm-hmm.
Today, we've developed vaccines against cervical cancer, but in those days, we were concerned about it.
Mm-hmm.
We were concerned about our female population as well as our male population.
Sure. Well, I guess, you know, if it's said somewhere in the Bible that because there are certain diseases you contract due to this extra piece of skin, it might be good to do something about it. It's different than saying, do it to your son or I'll kill you.
Time for a few more questions. In the glasses right here in the aisle.
First, congratulations on getting through it all.
Barely.
Barely.
It ain't over yet.
So if you don't mind, I'd like to come back to a question you've alluded to or an issue you've alluded to a mm-hmm. couple times today, which is I'm fascinated by how, given how you started out with such complete faith as a kid and then discovering that nothing horrible happened after you started driving on Shabbos and eating treif and all the other stuff. So how is it that you've retained your faith when clearly all the things that you thought were going to happen were horrible, and given that, you know, God's a horrible being, nothing happened, you got away with it. Didn't that mean it was all bullshit?
Well, you're right. I mean, partially, yeah. And partially that feeds the half of my brain that says, you know, this is all BS. But the general narrative arc of the formative books of my youth, which were Moses' books, we didn't read very many other things. The arc there seems to be everything's okay, something good happens, something bad happens. Something better happens, something much worse happens. And this graph just continues for eternity, right up until the present Holy Land situation. So the part of me that's still frightened just assumes that whatever good things are happening is just a setup for a worse thing. So I could say, well, I met my wife. That was great, right? Well, at the time, and I write about that in the book. And why, you know, maybe something is good. But at the same time, I think, well, he's just going to let me fall deeply in love before offing her. And it isn't a joke. I mean, it's not something I came up with on my own. This is a common thread among people taught this stuff, and it's a very hard cycle to break. So yeah, there's some proof that maybe it's all bogus. But there's also proof that he's just biding his time.
Lady right in front here.
I can sit. Well, I don't quite follow that whole attitude that's behind your experience. I myself came from a very Orthodox Jewish surroundings. And as a child, I took it just to me. I mean, I was more than anybody else was as a small kid.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into puberty, and I think one of the little reasons, not the real reasons, was when I saw my father do something on Shabbat that he shouldn't have done. And I never believed that he could, would, ever. That was the beginning of it, and I dropped the whole thing. But not with anger, and not with sort of secretly laughing about it, but I went through such a period of trying to solve the idea that I had been doing all that with more enthusiasm than anybody I could think of. And suddenly, from one moment to the next, or one day to the next, was going to lose it all. It was a serious matter, not making amusement out of it. Beg your pardon? Yeah. How can you explain your attitude?
Well, that costs me about $300 for 50 minutes once a week. In the first place, congratulations. You're very lucky. Having gotten out of it without any negative feelings toward it. As far as amusement, I don't think it's amusing. I don't know if you've read the book or not. Well, read the book. That's all I could say. It's a very painful reality dealt with in a way, the only way that I know to write about something for 300-400 pages without losing a reader. But it isn't amusing. It is angry. And I think I deserve to be. And I think a lot of people do. If you got out and you're happy with your life and happy with God and happy with religion, fantastic. Well, whatever the case is, it really has very little to do with where I came out from it. Okay. Right. Okay, you can be doubtful and I'll be angry. And we've covered the bases.
There's room for all of us. Shalom Auslander.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.